you ever wonder what parenting is really like? Do you think that you're the only one that's struggling? Or have you missed out on that amazing hack everyone was talking about? Well, that sounds like you. Grab a seat and get comfy, as you'll be hearing real life stories from parents that are on the same collective journey, a little thing called parenthood. We'll hear from parents, caregivers, and experts as we fumble through this wonderful path together. I'm your host, Rashida, and welcome to the Parents Connecting Podcast. Well, hi, everyone. Welcome back to Parents Connecting. Today, we're going to be hearing from Becky Tilley from the UK on a conversation around a rare genetic syndrome that she was diagnosed with. This was a really amazing conversation because Becky not only talked about some of the challenges that she faced when she was little, but what she did when she found out. And she didn't find out until she was an adult, which gives a really unique perspective on something that's that might be diagnosed really as a young child. So she was really able to reflect. And more than anything, she was really able to harness the power of positivity. And I think that it's really easy to get lost when you get a diagnosis of any sort. And I love Becky's perspective of the world and what she is doing for communities. And she's written a book. And so this is a really great episode. I hope that you get a lot out of it. And then stay tuned. I will have some takeaways. And then we will put all of the information in the show notes. If you know somebody that has a rare genetic condition and needs some support, Becky is a great resource. All right, well, let's get into it. Well, hi, Becky. Thank you so much for joining the podcast. I'm really excited to talk with you and have your story shared.
Me too. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. So Becky is a 39-year-old mom of three from the UK. She and her two children have been diagnosed with a rare genetic disorder called Coulin-Debris. And so we're just here to hear her story and how she's dealt with it through her childhood and how she's worked through some of the challenges, I'm sure, as a mother raising three children. So Becky, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
So why don't we just get started with maybe an introduction of the genetic syndrome that you have and give us a little bit of information on what it is and maybe how you discovered it, and then we'll walk through what happened since.
Yes, absolutely. Well, it's a very interesting story because I'd actually lived with, you know, Coulin-Debris for 38 years and never knew.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
So very
I actually discovered it. Yeah, the first diagnosis was actually in 2006. So I was obviously born in the 1980s, so there'd be no such genetic testing to have picked that up. So I grew up with learning difficulties. I was in special ed class for English and maths. And I always felt behind compared to my peers, didn't feel like I really fit in. Even though I was very sociable, I struggled academically all through my school years. And I figured just from how other people treated me that maybe I just, you know, wasn't very bright. And I just adopted the label that I was pretty stupid compared to everybody else, which obviously wasn't true. It was just how I was treated a lot of the time. I was made to feel like that by some of my peers and employers, that kind of thing. And it was very frustrating for me and annoying because I was always think, why can't I just be like everyone else? Why can't I keep up with everybody else? Why don't I have the same abilities? You know, why aren't I practically minded or academically minded? So I had all these question marks over my head my entire life, never knowing why I didn't quite. Why I was so different to everyone else. And little did I know that in 2020, following the birth of my beautiful boy, who unfortunately had a lot of health issues and he had to stay in NICU for 34 days. And while he was in there, he was diagnosed with something called floppy baby syndrome. And the medical term for that is hypotonia, which is low muscle tone. And it can make your limbs go very floppy and limp. And it's a condition that could get better, worse, or stay the same.
Okay, I was just going to ask, developed. Is that something that has progressed? Or, okay.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, thankfully, I'm thrilled to say that my son's just gone from strength to strength. He was walking before I was as a child.
So, oh, that's
yeah,
so sweet.
Age one, he was away. He's runs, he jumps, he climbs. Everything any other child would do, he does. which is amazing. He had physio from the earliest age. But it was through that, it was through 18 months of blood tests and specialist appointments to figure out why he had hypertonia. There's a lot of genetic disorders and diseases attached to that. So it was a very stressful time. And surprisingly, during that time, we saw Josh progressing. He was doing so well. Obviously, hypertonia was not an issue. So we figured that maybe he was okay, that there wasn't actually anything genetic going on. And surprise, we ended up pregnant again with our third baby. So we just thought, oh, this is amazing. So Josh is doing well. And obviously, we got our first one, Bella, who was fine. She's had no issues at all. And then 4 months into my pregnancy, I get a telephone call from my geneticist. And I was quite surprised, you know, you see that name flash up on your phone. And I think, why is she calling me? Because I thought, you know, she doesn't call me often. So she's obviously got something to tell me.
Yeah, doctors are one of those things where it's like no news is good news almost.
Yes. So. Yeah. And she called to say, you know, we finally discovered Joshua's condition. And I kind of sat down and was like, oh my gosh, what is it? As in, you know, they obviously discovered he had genetic disorder. And they said, Joshua has a disorder called Coulon-Devries syndrome. And I was just thinking, oh my gosh, I've never heard of that. What does it mean? What is it about? And before I had a chance to ask that, they said he inherited it from you. As in, from me as his mother. So basically, they not only told me that my son had it, but that I had it also, and I had no idea what the syndrome was, what it was about. And I revealed to them, you know, I'm 4 months pregnant as well. They said, well, thanks so much for telling us, because she now has a 50% chance of having the syndrome as well.
Wow.
So I was
so what were you feeling? Did they tell you, I guess, what does that mean in that moment for you? And then what does it mean now?
Oh, well, at the time, I was just blindsided by guilt, really. Mm. Just, I thought back to the painful start that he had. You know, he was severely jaundiced and all the, like, a battery of blood tests. It seemed never ending, especially while I was in hospital. They were in and out jabbing him all the time. And the memories of that were really hard because it happened during COVID as well. So the pandemic was going on at the same time.
So when was your, you said you had your second baby during, was that 2020? When did you have your second child?
Yes. Yeah, I had him in March 2020.
Oh, so right. So right weeks. After, was it right after they declared the pandemic?
And it was 2 weeks after he was born, the pandemic broke out.
Oh my gosh. Oh, wow.
Yes. Okay. So while I was in hospital with my son, my husband was saying it's like an apocalypse out here and the whole world was going mad. So it was just the most emotionally intense time of my entire life. So I thought that was, you know, that was pretty rough. And then I also get the phone call 18 months later to say that me and potentially two of my children all have, you know, Coulon-Devries. And thankfully, I mean, it was really painful time. I already had anxiety disorder, which I kind of palmed off as me just being a warrior.
Right.
But
which is easy to do. That's really easy to do, I think.
Yes. Because, yeah. Yeah. But obviously that pushed me clean over the edge. It was skyrocketing. I'd never known anxiety like it. And it was the first time I actually reached out for, you know, professional help and just saying, look, I'm just not managing just emotionally or mentally. This is really too much for me to take. And, the best help I actually got was from my genetics counselor, who was the first one that gave me permission to feel guilty.
Oh, wow.
As in, yeah, because
like that's okay, whenever, right?
Which whenever I spoke to my family or friends and just said, you know, tears saying the guilt's like eating me alive, they'd say, oh, no, you can't feel guilty. It wasn't your fault, you know. So I had all these feelings I needed to let out and I'd have to suppress them because no one gave me permission to.
Isn't it amazing when somebody just allows you to feel what you feel, no matter what the feeling is, just unapologetic to be able to get it out. It like, it's so releasing to just say, yes, I am allowed to feel this way.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, she's someone I've written about in my book. She's someone that the whole world knows about, actually. My geneticist, she's just incredible. And she was the first one to hear me out, to let the tears flow, to for me to really let out all my innermost thoughts and emotions about it all. And she had nothing but compassion. But she also was very quick to say, this does not define you. As in, you are so much more than this. This is not your identity. This is only a part of who you are. Yes, Joshua has Coulon de Vries, but he's also a brother and he's a son and he's going to be somebody's friend. And so she went from giving me that release that I so needed. So I already felt calmer from releasing that massive weight I'd been carrying. And then she ended it so beautifully with, you know, I'm going to leave you now, but no, this doesn't define who you are. As in, like, you've not given this identity to your son. He's way more than this, and so are you. And I'm just thinking, oh my gosh. Like, she was just like an absolute godsend. She said everything I needed to hear to be able to heal, move forward.
That's beautiful. What a gift. I mean, because I think so easily sometimes in any medical profession, things can seem so transactional. And so It's really wonderful that you found somebody that had like this humanistic side to just allow you to be and feel. And
absolutely. Yeah. And she's continued to be a support. Even when I reached out to her when she's been on holiday, she's called me from London on the weekend from her hotel just to check in on me. Like, she's...
Oh, wow.
Yeah. She's really... You talk about rare disorder. She's rare in terms of her heart that she has, how much she cares for her patients, I guess. She's,
oh my gosh,
really incredible human being. Yeah.
So how old are your children now?
So Isabella, she's 5, Joshy, 3, and Avery will be 2. So they're all very close.
Oh wow. So you've got 3 under 5. Wow. That's a lot. I have 2. I have 2 5 and under, and you know, it's a lot. Having a third one in the mix is, I just can't imagine.
So, yes. Absolutely.
so you know, you mentioned that as a child you didn't realize, or nobody, you know, there wasn't any genetic testing going on, you just felt sort of behind, and then you discovered this thing in your adult life. Do you think that in terms of your upbringing, like with your parents, did they have any sense? Because I think generationally, you know, we learn and evolve as the generations go. So how was that? Do you have any siblings, I guess is the other question.
I do. I'm the youngest of 6 children.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. That's a big family.
Big family. Yes. So my mom and dad were actually tested for Coulon de Vries.
Okay. Oh, interesting.
And neither of them have it.
That's very interesting. Do any of your siblings, were your siblings tested?
Well, they were given the option, but none of them wanted to.
That's a Pandora's box, I'm sure. Okay. And so it sounds like just growing up, you felt a little different and you were able to grow up and just kind of went through life. And then all of a sudden you're 38 years old and you hear, hey, you have this thing, and possibly your children have it as well. You were pregnant at that point. So what's your like next step? Like, what did you go and research it? Did you, you know, did you have support around you? It sounds like you found a great geneticist who is there for you.
Yeah. I mean, that's really interesting, because I did run to Google, even when they swore me not to, to just read all the horror stories.
And yes.
It's so true. So I deliberately thought, okay, I'm going to use Google to my advantage. And I looked at hope stories. I wanted to look for families who defied the odds, who were told one thing by the doctor, but another thing turned out and the kids are thriving. I thought, I want to look for those stories because I know they're out there. And I've always been someone that's always on the lookout for someone inspiring who's overcome adversity. And I've always soaked those stories up, and I've always liked to be inspired in life. So I thought, so now I need, as in, this isn't just one, I need inspiration. I need hope. And I found it in the most beautiful ways, found some amazing families online, and I could feel that hope rising up in me. And I thought, wouldn't it be a blessing if I could give this same gift to somebody else? So I actually joined a KDVS International Support Group on Facebook, found a couple of them. And I thought, you know what can I share that might offer hope to somebody? Because from what I could see, everyone with Coulon de Vries is younger than I am. As in, they're either young adults or their children. And I thought, what have I achieved in life? You know, I've been employed, as in I've had employment, because I know it can cause mild to moderate intellectual disability. It can cause developmental delays, obviously learning difficulties that I had. It does cause health issues as well for some. You know, heart and kidney issues can also, as a 50% chance of having epilepsy as well. So I thought, you know, I've not had, thank goodness, and I, you know, I'm grateful, I've not had any health issues regarding KWS, nor have my children. But I just said, I can share the learning side of things, what I've achieved. So mm-hmm.
Do you think not knowing almost worked to your advantage to some degree, up, right?
Yeah. It was actually a relief. I went, once I'd moved through the guilt, because that was pretty heavy laden on me. Once I processed that and moved through, I saw it as like a blessing in disguise, in terms of I've always had this enormous question mark hanging over my head as to why I'm so different and not understanding, almost willing myself to be like everyone else and trying to fit in and desperately trying to be like everyone else. And I just thought, and I've never managed to achieve it. And it's like, now I know why. I know I was never meant to fit in, you know.
So that's great. So now that you have, you know that you have two children that have this syndrome, do you think, have you talked to them about it? And do you think you will?
I definitely think I will. I will. I mean, like I said, I know what it's like to go through school. I mean, I actually see it as something that's going to help them tremendously, because I'm already their greatest advocate. You know, I've got Josh going to nursery, and I said, you know, I've got Coulon de Vries. It can cause developmental delays. I said he needs to do sign language. We do sign language at home because he needs speech and language therapy. And he is so loved at nursery. He's got so many friends. He has so much fun. So I'm just thrilled with how he's been embraced with open arms there, and he's really thriving in his own uniquely wonderful way. And he does signs there all the time. He'll play with his friends and he'll ask them for things with sign language, and they'll do it, that they will respond to him. And it's just like, oh my gosh, I think because I had such a rough start in my school education, I just thought it was just joy to hear. And I just think it kind of inspired me hugely, and also gave me a responsibility. I almost didn't give myself an option not to be, but to be the best role model for somebody with Coulon de Vries that I could possibly be, because I never had that growing up. I just thought I was different, I was weird, and you know, no one could understand or relate to me, and that's how I felt. Whereas they won't only have someone that can relate and understand what it is they're going through, but also that someone who will show them what is possible.
Right. You know, so talk about the possibilities. So what have you been able to do, and what, like, do you think has helped you through that? It sounds like you were looking for hopeful messages, but as you have, you know, gone through life, not even knowing, you know, what do you think has been your, sounds like you're a very resilient person who doesn't, you know, keeps going through life.
It's amazing you should say that, and thank you for the beautiful compliment, but that was definitely not always the case. It's incredible how, was it the greatest traumas of your life, traumas I'd read about, and admiring people like, wow, you know, you've been through that and you're still strong and you've got this amazing outlook on life. And I always thought, oh wow, imagine being one of those people. And I always imagine what it would be like to be someone that people could read about and be inspired by. And I had no idea that opportunity would come around for me, especially not in this form. But I think I've always been a very, according to everyone else, an encourager, a very nurturing nature. For example, if I'm in a crowded, busy room and I see someone that's looking alone and look a bit, you know, no one to talk to, I'll be the first to run over and say, introduce myself, how are you doing? You know, especially in work as well. Because even though I struggled at work, whenever there was someone new on board, I'd be mm-hmm. the first to run over and show them the ropes, because I knew what it was like. And I think I've always continued in that way, really, because my husband even said to me once, he said, after we've been through bullying-wise and all that kind of thing, he said, I don't know
how you're still so loving and open, and how you, why you care so much about people when you've been so poorly treated. He said it could have made you bitter, but he said it's had the opposite effect. It's just made you want to bring people in. And so I thought, because I'd always wanted to be, like I said, that person of encouragement and inspiration, I thought, well, maybe this is my time, because I know it's a spectrum, and that I thought maybe these families could be looking for hope. And I was right, I'm glad to say, because I said that I'd been to college and had a diploma in performing arts drama, and been employed, I was married, had three kids, and the amount of responses I got and comments of just, we're so happy you found us. I've got hope for my child now that I never had before, in terms of what their life might look like, because most parents want their kids to be happy and to, you know, and
thrive,
to, and just to enjoy life and have what they have as such, you know. And I thought, wow, I thought, because I've got Kulun de Vries and it's for life, I didn't have to stop doing this. Like, I can be a constant encouragement and source of support for these families, and I have been. I've not left since I joined.
That's great. So, and yeah. So for folks that don't really know much about Kulun de Vries, what can you tell us? What do they typically tell the person that has been diagnosed? And then what have you experienced personally? Has it like fallen in that range? Because oftentimes, you know, doctors will give you, you know, an average or some sort of diagnosis, and here's what you can expect, right? And then there's the actual life happenings of, you know, it does or doesn't actually come to fruition. What, you know, what is the like, if somebody looked up Kulun de Vries, what are they going to find? What's the typical markers? And then what did you experience specifically, just for, because I'm sure it's unique to each person. And then we can talk about maybe some examples of things that you maybe encountered.
I mean, it's, as you rightly said, my geneticist even said, so they said, don't overwhelm yourself by looking at all the signs and symptoms of it. And it is extensive now. There is so much that can affect you in multiple ways, and things health-wise, obviously, in terms of learning, like I said, mild to moderate intellectual disability, developmental delays, you know, and I think some people have actually even questioned if I have the disorder, because
you don't present as a typical person.
Yeah, they hear how I talk and see how I write, and like, oh, you, and I am 100% sure that I have it, but I'm just proof that it is a spectrum. Mm-hmm. How it affects one, it won't affect the other that way. I mean, I was an early talker, which I think everyone could believe I'm talking to me. But in terms of walking, my kids were both walking. Even Avery, who was started walking within the last 2-3 months, was still before me, who started walking near the age of 2. So again, so it's affected us all differently. They both diagnosed with hypertonia, both need speech and language support, whereas I didn't. So I think even just with the three of us, you can see how it varies. So I don't overwhelm myself, because anxiety is still something I manage, but it's still very much there. So if I allow myself to go into every symptom and sign, I probably really overwhelm myself. So I try to distance myself from it. Like, I know the core things that will come up if you Google it, but I don't look at every, like you said, every potential thing, because sometimes I think they do exaggerate in terms of, this is everything that could happen, right, to cover themselves. If you
that's,
know what I mean.
You know, I'm glad you said that, because that's a good, I think that's a good piece to reiterate, because it is so easy to have somebody tell you something and you get not even overwhelmed, but just the sheer amount of information out there. You know, you could almost, you could prove that you have something that maybe you just don't even have, just by, you know, like little tiny little things, but, oh, maybe this is that, and maybe this is that. And that's, I think, where your anxiety can shoot up, because you're right. Yeah, yeah. I think that just as you can manifest the negative, right, if you're in that sort of negative spot, you can also manifest the positive. And so it sounds like, you know, you intentionally chose to like steer yourself towards the positive, which I think is great, because I think you, I really think, you know, from a, even like a psychology standpoint, you can really you know, like I said, you can manifest the positive thing, like the power of positive thinking really is there. And I think, you know, as a younger person, I myself probably thought that was like, oh, it's all frou-frou, like, you know, but, you know, as you age and you get older, you get a little wiser and you're, no, it's an actual thing, you know? And so I think who you're hanging around with, the information that you surround yourself with, like that all yeah. impacts you. So that's great. It sounds like you took, you know, you're on that path. And you talk about positivity and trying to share your story so that it can help others. And you yeah. wrote a book. So I'd love to talk about, you know, your book and what's in the book and how, and what led you there, I guess. How did you decide to write a book?
Yeah, well, I think I started off with just a brief of my story for the KDVS community alone. And then I thought, oh, I really enjoyed writing that. You know, I love encouraging. I thought maybe I should write a blog. So I emailed the KDVS Foundation and said, please, can I do a blog for you? Because I want to reach more families outside of this group. So I did that. I did my first blog. Again, it was really well received. And then because I joined a support group, I decided to create my own support groups on Facebook. So I've got a UK KDVS support group and I've got a international called Mama's Heart International Support Group. And that's families of all different rare diseases and disorders from all over the world, just to come together and have someone to reach out if they need to, or just have some encouragement from someone that has one, that has a disorder. Because again, I just wanted people to know they're not alone, to give hope in people in whatever way that I could. And even though I've done all this, I thought, oh, listen, I still need to do something more. And I'd always had the dream of writing a book, and I had so many failed attempts at writing one. I'd write a paragraph and, like, you know, bin it and scrap it.
Right, right.
And I couldn't make a chapter out of that. And then that one would be binned as well. You know, it just so many tries. But I think I used to encourage people, I would send like a weekend message to my family and friends. That's just nice. A message of encouragement for you today. Yeah. And I think in the end, it got a bit grating on them a bit. The other days of the week, because I just had such a heart to encourage. Yeah, and then I thought, I've really got to do something. And they're like, why don't you write a book? As in, like, get all that writing energy out. I thought, actually, that's
a great idea. That's
it is, but it took
how long did it take? Yeah.
So long. Like I said, and attempts before the diagnosis that I made to write a book, and I could never think of anything to write about.
Oh, so you've always had this sort of inkling to write a book. Yeah. Oh, that's great. Yeah.
Before the diagnosis, even. Yeah.
Just as a positive encouragement, like just maybe share your story. That's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Because, but like I said, I could find a blog in like my mind, but I couldn't like a book. So I was in like, not got enough to write a book. And something about the experience that I'd had and that desire in me to encourage just grew bigger, as in couldn't be contained. And I thought, yeah, I need to flood this out into a book now. And I'm someone that loves quotes. I'm always Googling life quotes on Pinterest, all that kind of thing, and you know, I'll make one my screensaver on my phone kind of thing if I really like it. So I thought, why not do a quotes book? Isn't that, can't be hard, right? As in, create my own life quotes and stick them all in a book. So I did one for every day of the year, so I didn't have to worry about chapters so much. I just did a quote, because that's easy enough. And it took, I don't know, however many months to do that, and I finished it, and I thought, great, that's my book done. But it looks really bare, as in page after page, just 1, 2, 3, 4, quote. So it doesn't really look like a book to me. And then I thought, so what can I add to it? So I thought, because, you know, I've got so much to write about, as everyone keeps reminding me, I decided to add a life experience to the quote to go with it, as in make a link between the quote and this is why I wrote it, as in either this is my outlook on life or this is the life experience I've had to back it up, basically. And then I did that through my book and was like, well, that's good, but what's anyone meant to take away from this in terms of they read it, and what's the, like, when they close the book, what are they thinking? And then I realized at the end I'll put something to remember, and that is the takeaway part, you know, because every blog or story you read has an ending that will leave you the message that you think, yes, like, that's kind of brings it all full circle. So every page, there's a little bit at the end for you to take away, and you know, either action or just so something to keep in mind when those situations come up. Just think, okay, I can choose to behave or think or do different in terms of maybe in a better direction. So that's what the something to remember is for. And now I think it's about 377 pages I ended up writing.
Oh, that's great. That. What like an accomplishment. Really. Congratulations. Yes,
thank you. And it's split into three parts. It's split into parenting in terms of everything I've learned to raise your kids to believe in themselves, teach them self-love from the youngest age, how fundamental it is that they believe in themselves and are confident in their abilities, whatever those abilities may be, that they don't believe they're less than anyone else. And even more so that you wouldn't believe they're less than anyone else because, you know, because
how do you encourage that? Because I love that. I know we're only on point number two, but I want to stop you there because that's a really important thing to talk about, is to being able to raise children to believe in themselves. Because if you can believe in yourself, then it doesn't matter what anybody else thinks. And that is really easier said than done because of just the plethora of things out there. Yeah, and, you know, it seems so frivolous. But I'm curious, like, do you have any examples that you want to share of things that you've used for your own children or for yourself that has helped to just, you know, reconfirm that innate, like, you know, that essentially that self-love, right? To be able to love who you are, accept who you are, and not, you know, take in what other people say.
Yes, completely. I mean, a lot of that has come from being the example myself, which is the biggest work, actually. I mean, it's one thing to, and obviously I'd always encourage everyone to say that, is to tell your kids you're amazing and you're beautiful and you're brave and you're strong, but tell them why, you know, and I just think the greatest way is to, for example, my daughter, because I was bullied a lot at school, I understand the importance of, again, from a young age, standing up for yourself and knowing when to say no. And my daughter has learned to do that. Don't get me wrong, she's still learning. She's four. Bless her. But I thought, I don't want her to go through the same experience I had. Example, you know, I was bullied at high school, in the workplace. So, and it all starts in those early years, as in, when children are most vulnerable is when they can get attacked the most. So I'm really trying to teach my daughter, and I always tell her, you're so brave and you're so strong. And I don't ever tell her not to tell a teacher. I always say, you let the teacher know if someone's upsetting you, because I appreciate how young she is. And I want to make sure they're keeping an eye out for her and whoever's giving her a hard time. But I said, you know, but I said at the same time, girly, I said, you have to tell them no. As in, you know, and so if she is being treated the wrong way or someone scaring her for whatever reason, then, you know, just to say that, as in, just let them know that's not okay, that it's not okay to treat you that way.
And so it's really just verbalizing that, say, hey, don't speak like that to me, or that's not absolutely nice, or
completely. Because, and the reason I feel so passionately about it is because I never did. And I was bullied physically and verbally by a gang of boys, and just knowing that I could help my daughter, I could help protect her from that by teaching her to say no. And even it helps because she's got siblings. If her brother's winding her up and like knocking on the head or something, and she's like, "Mommy," and then like tell Joshy no,
right,
tell
him
and
right, like, yeah,
and then, you know, and it's so I just say like, this is great training ground, really, because Josh is your little brother and you're bigger and stronger than he is. As in, so you can say no to Joshy, right? You know, and then she gets used to saying no to him and telling him enough. So it's that can transfer across to when those boys come along at school, she'll already be trained at home as to how to say no. And it's all trial and error. I'm not saying, you know, it's the perfect way to do
it. Yeah, I don't think there's a silver bullet on any of this stuff. It's really what works for your family, what works for the person, what works for your child, and what works for you. Because I do think it's so easy for anybody to place judgment on, oh, well, that's not the right way, or that doesn't sound right. But the reality is we're all trying to do our best. And we all want, at the end of the day, we all want our kids to thrive and to be happy and to love themselves. And I think that if that's, you know, if that's something that works, then do it, right? And if that's something that encourages your daughter and helps her stay confident, then I think that's wonderful.
Yeah. And I think as well, I think how we teach our children comes a lot from our own life experiences, mm-hmm. our own childhoods. I think
absolutely.
We'll definitely manifest into how we raise our kids.
Yes. And right or wrong, right? Because our own absolutely. Childhood experiences might not always be the most positive. So.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. And on a lighter note, is that my son, Josh, like I said, he's so loved at nursery and he loves going in there. He's so full of confidence and joy. And I went to take him in the other day and he was greeted at the gate. And someone said, oh, look, everyone, Josh is here. And all these friends started rushing towards the gate. And I thought, that's a bit of a welcome, isn't it, Josh? And then she explained to me, she said, oh, I just called them all over because he gives everybody a morning hug when he comes in the morning.
That's so sweet.
So they all wanted to come over for the hug from him in the morning. And they said he gives the staff a hug as well. So it's role modeling, you know, kindness and love. So it's not all the hard stuff, but then you need to stand up for yourself. It's actually, again, the kindness and the warmth then. Because again, I understand the importance of having others be kind to you. So teaching my kids to be kind to those
around
them.
Receive. Yeah, I think kindness is something completely. That I can see it when the child does something. We have this book that we read. It's like, I can't remember the exact title, but it's, you know, how to fill a bucket or something. It's about this invisible bucket. And once, you know, everybody has their invisible buckets that they're carrying around, they want it to be full, and acts of kindness, like fill your bucket.
Oh, I love
and
it, that.
You know,
yeah.
And so it's, you know, there's a sense of pride that when you give something to somebody. And so I think almost not only encouraging it, but like reflecting, like, oh, wow, like look at, you know, this act of kindness, whatever, you know, thing it was, opposed to sharing or, you know, offering their seat to somebody, or I don't know. Showing like, oh, look, your brother is that really appreciates that and happy, you know, is really happy. And there is like a sense of joy, like an internal sense of joy. It's not like an external stimulus, you know, like an external incentive. I think that's a great thing to encourage because that could never be taken away.
Yes. Yeah. 100%. And Bella came home with a sticker from school saying, well done. I said, oh, what's your sticker for? And she said, oh, it was for being kind.
Oh,
and I said,
the best thing.
I love that your school celebrates that, like character traits versus mm-hmm. only academic.
Oh, absolutely.
You know?
So that'll go so much, like, you know, farther in life, I think, if you have really, and I say that, I say the jokingly, but I really mean that seriously. I think that your personality traits and how you show up around other people, even in the sense of adversity or challenges, that resonates with people rather than coming to somebody with a really negative viewpoint. And that's fine. Like if you're, you know, people are in different phases of their life and they're going to go through various things, but that's beautiful. Like, you know, just having a, you know, job well done and being, and having somebody, like you said, encourage that and appreciate it.
Yes. Yeah, completely. Yeah.
So what would you say to anybody that maybe they were in your shoes and they've just been told, you know, your child has this genetic condition? What would you tell them?
Pretty good question. I would just say, it makes me think what my geneticist said to me is to always remember them more than their diagnosis, you know, to always see them as your precious child who's capable of achieving great things and becoming strong and beautiful and successful in their own way. Because I don't think, like you said, I don't think there's any one line of success. You know, I see my child thriving in nursery with Coulon DeVries and speech and language delay, and he's loving life. He's, you know, the staff and kids love him there. He's getting on so well, and I see, so he's succeeding. To me, he's succeeding in nursery. He doesn't need to be, you know, as in at the same level developmentally as his peers, to be succeeding. You know, it's because the confidence,
like the measure of success isn't a straight bar. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So just to not compare, I would say, you know, I know I'm not saying in that essence to neglect the additional support they need. Again, I got a physiotherapist, I've got a speech and language therapist for advice. So always get the support they need when you know they need that. You make sure they've got it, but don't use that as a reason to compare, as in just use that to bring them along, to bring out even more of who they are and what they're capable of, and really not see it as more than that, but just supporting them and thriving, as in to just keep that mindset the whole time in terms of they're no less than anyone else. They're just thriving in their own way. And I'm going to do everything I can to allow that.
That's wonderful. And then how about, I'm curious, as an adult, since you did discover this as an adult, let's say there was somebody in your shoes who, as an adult, they've reflected and they thought, or maybe they're hearing this and they think, that sounds maybe like I might have this. What would you tell them as a source of encouragement and maybe even a source of from a resource perspective?
Yeah, definitely look up. I would say support groups is a key thing, whatever that condition or disorder is. I think there's really high chance on Facebook.
Yeah, for sure. I feel like there's a group about for everything.
I look at different forums. I mean, I've done 19 blogs. I've had 19 blogs published for rare organizations. And there are so many out there. There's so much support available. I'm really part of a really incredible community. I've made so many connections through rare organizations who really care about people. And it's really heartwarming to think about it, you know, that these people have been such an amazing support to me. They've helped support me with my book. They've allowed me to share my story through blogging. And so yeah, just to know that, I think most importantly, to know they're not alone.
Yeah, just sharing your story is so critical. I mean, just you coming on here and sharing your story and being willing to open this about, you know, what you've experienced. And I think that, like you said, just hearing somebody else's experience through something can be so connecting, because then they you know that you're not alone. And that in and of itself is really, I think, comforting. And allows you to maybe like move through it. Cause I think it can be very isolating to have anything, right? To experience anything negative.
So. Yeah. I mean, you know, I couldn't imagine if there was no social media, how I would be doing. I mean, this has been like, you know, almost, it's like my life now in terms of sharing my story and my message and being of encouragement. And so I would just say, it was such a huge thing for me, and it continues to support and allow me to thrive, having all these amazing opportunities, connecting with so many from all around the world. So I would just say to not stay isolated, as in, I know, even though if you feel it, to not allow that to kind of take over, to reach out, even if you're afraid to reach out to a rare organization that provides help and support for people with rare diseases, join support groups, to just get connected as much as possible, because I think you will find, like I did, it's in my immediate circle, family and friends, even my husband, who is incredible, and I absolutely adore him. He's got no idea what it's like to live with a rare disorder, where there's so many people all over the world that do get it. So I just say, it helps. I think being reminded you're not alone can't be underestimated. I think it just makes such a massive, massive difference.
That's beautiful. And so tell people how they can find you. Like, it sounds like you have developed your own support groups and you've got a following. Tell people how they can find you. And we'll put this all in the show notes, of course, but just for everybody.
Yeah. So on Facebook, it's UK KDVS support group, because I noticed there wasn't one for the UK. There's an international one, and there's also one called KDVS Raw, which is where you just go to let it out, whatever it is. And I thought there's one that I think might help for the UK, just because there's different, obviously every country has its own support available in terms of school education, all that kind of thing, what's available after school. So it's all UK based, so I thought they've got a hub for that as such. And then the international one was because I didn't want to leave anybody out. Again, it's Toulon de Vries families, but also families with other disorders or individuals. You don't have to be a mum and dad, you know, you can be, you know, a teenager or whatever, just whatever age you are, and, you know, just welcome to join, anybody is. So Mama's Heart International Support Group, that's called. And in terms of my book and my daily encouragements that I love to share, that I still do, is Instagram. So Thriving Rare, it's called on Instagram, Thrive Rare on Facebook. And I also have Thrive Rare. Realize it's only been recent. I've joined Twitter now. And also YouTube. I have Thrive Rare on YouTube, where I do daily YouTube videos.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it's so interesting, this whole like social media, where you can go anywhere with it. And it sounds like you're on multiple platforms. So
yeah.
People can find you wherever they consume data. So we'll definitely put all that stuff in the show notes. And it sounds like it's great. I like the daily encouragement. Sometimes it's interesting because sometimes you just need that one little quote and you read it and you're like, oh, that makes all the difference in the world. So that's beautiful. And where can people find your book?
Oh, Amazon.
On Amazon.
Yes, right. So I can send you the link for that. That's fine. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. Well, yes. I mean, thank you so much for being here. We'll definitely put all your information and the link to the book where people can purchase the book. So thank you so much.
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
And then before we go, on season two, I have questions to try to help people just know random things of what other people do. So yes, my question
is, you're not alone, isn't it?
Exactly. This is the effort to not make anybody feel alone and how each person deals with things. So we are going to talk about bedtime routines because they're so unique to each individual and how many people you have. So my first question is, what time do your kids go to bed and what time do they wake up? So what's their routine like?
Okay, well, our kids tend to go to bed for 6:30. We'll get them up for bath time. So all three of them, because they're all under 5, get them in the bath together, bubble bath, great. Bath toys. Yeah. So the floor is usually like soaked in bubbles by the end. Yeah.
So how long does that take? I'm curious. So like, how long does it take to bathe all three kids?
About 20 minutes. 20 minutes.
Wow, half an hour. That's fast. Okay.
It depends. Sometimes they're tired. They just want to get in and out. You know,
right.
Other times they're happy to have more of a play with toys in the bath and splash me and daddy kind of thing.
Yeah.
It all depends what mood they're in, really. So if they're uber cranky, we're like, right, we're getting you in, washing, getting you out.
Yeah.
No, we're not delaying getting you to bed. So yeah, we kind of follow their lead in terms of like how quick. We always make sure they have a wash, but you know, if they're grumpy or in a bad mood, we'll make sure we get them up pretty quick. And then after that, we all go downstairs to my son's room because he has story time. And so basically my son, my husband, and my two daughters will all sit on Josh's bed and have a story together. And then, I'll just sit and join them as well. And then after that, my husband puts Josh to sleep, as in just the two of them. And then I go upstairs with my oldest daughter and we have a story again. So I read her a story with Avery, who tends to just go around her room playing with her toys while we have a story. And then after that, we put Bella to bed. I say goodnight with Avery on my hip and then I go downstairs and then Avery is last. You know, she's the youngest, she's last going to sleep. So she'll have a hug with me downstairs. She still has a bottle at the moment. So she'll just feed herself, just in my arms on the sofa, really quiet, we don't have any TV on or anything. And she'll just peacefully drift off. And then we get her to bed and then that's it.
Oh, that's
and
sweet.
Yeah.
It sounds like everybody has their own individual, like it's nice because they got they have a little bit of togetherness. And then they each get a little bit of time with you. So that's really lovely.
Oh, thank you. And in the morning, I tend to get them up for 6:30 now because I found that when I got up with them at 7, like my husband said, like you're fighting fires for the minute you get out of bed. As in like, we're all up together. We're all tired. We're all blurry eyed, trying to find clothes and stuff. And it's just like, it was just absolute chaos. It's always a frantic dash to get them to nursery and school, literally running down the road with the parents staring at me.
Right,
just like,
right. No, it's true.
I can't do this anymore. As in like, this is just wake up with a sense of dread every morning to get everyone ready. And it's just like, I don't want this. This isn't good. So I actually set my alarm for 5 every morning.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So I'll get up at 5. I'll spend an hour writing my new book. So I'm already writing the second one. And I'll write, you know, I'll do my YouTube video for the day or my quote for the day. and my books all within that hour. No, it's about an hour and a half, actually, because I tend to go till 6:30, depending if my kids are up.
That's like you really have your own time for yourself, quiet. Oh my kids gosh, that's so wonderful.
What a difference it makes in terms of, by the time my kids are up, I've got a clear headspace. I've had time to wake up. I'm alert because I've been writing, which always is like a positive for me to do. So by the time they come down, I'm like a completely different person in terms of how I was with them at the same time.
And how long have you been doing that? Like from waking up?
Only a week.
A week. Oh, well, that's enough to know. Like, wow, there's such a difference here.
It is. Yeah. And it's just, you know, and it's sometimes, you know, I'll be like, right, everyone's ready to go. Everyone's got the shoes, coats. And it's like, oh, we've got like 20 minutes left to spare. And it's like, I can sit on the sofa for 10 minutes and go, oh my gosh, we're actually ready. And then I realize I can run down the road like a mad woman with everyone staring at me. And it's just, it's so lovely. I mean, we even got there and we were like there with everybody else before the bell rang for school. And I was like, it never happens. It's just amazing.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah. So I'd really, really recommend that time for yourself, because you just get a chance to get your head right for the day. Mm-hmm. To get your head straight. Yeah,
it's interesting because I'll share what our bedtime routine is. So I have a 2 and a 5-year-old, and we just recently moved them. It's been a few months, but we put them into the same room. They were each in their separate rooms.
Wow.
But yeah, so they were going to bed around the same time, and you know, we have only a 3-bedroom house and I needed an office space. And we thought, well, they're already sleeping together. Let's see what that looks like. We'll put them together. And it worked pretty well. I think the first week or so they were, you know, sometimes they play and talk and sing and, you know, do whatever they want. But my son is still in the crib. So that has helped a lot. It's so interesting. Like, yes, like it's so interesting, the difference between girls and boys. Like my daughter at 18 months was already, you know, with the rail, and you know, so she was like getting potty trained at that point. But we've kept the boy in the crib. It works because he's like inside, he can't get out. So we read them a story. I don't know what's gonna happen once we open that up.
How that would work well.
Yeah, so we do dinner, we brush your teeth, we get them in their pajamas, they each get to pick a story. A book. And then sometimes mom or dad will pick an extra book. So we read them each a story, and then we sing a song, and then
love that.
And then we, you know, turn off the lights and say goodnight. And so it's interesting because some days they like go to bed pretty quickly, and other days, like my son will be singing for half an hour, but you know, it all works out.
I love that. Oh, that's so precious.
And then in the morning, you know, what's interesting is in the morning, they tended to wake up early, like around 6:30, between 6 and 7 sometimes. But the early part, like my husband has now started to wake up very early. He wakes up, you know, at 4:00, he actually goes to pray and he has like an hour. Yeah. So he has a whole thing. And I don't know if you're familiar with the book, The Miracle Morning, but that is a book that talks about, you know, a morning practice and stuff. So the moments, I mean, I cannot agree more with what you said about, even if it's 30 minutes, even if it's 15 minutes, if you just get up slightly before your kids do and you're just center yourself, even just the quiet, just a little bit of quiet, and you're like, whoa, you could get up without feeling. Because as soon as they're up, it's mommy, daddy, you know, and it's like, you can't quiet. You're always behind. You're always feeling pretty much. So I completely agree.
And it's like of your mind the minute they come downstairs. It's what do you want?
So like my husband's like able to get up. He does his thing. He makes the breakfast like before anybody's up, or like at least a little bit before they're up. So then that way we can all sit down to have breakfast together. We do try to eat breakfast together. So, but it is a difficult and sometimes very chaotic, especially on really early mornings. You know, you have to get out the door by, you know, some appointment or something. So I feel like anybody that has children under 5, especially multiples, it's just like constant chaos.
It is. Yes.
But it's a good thing, 100%. I guess. And then I guess my second question is, what time do you go to bed? And we've heard about what time do you wake up, but what is your routine like?
I tend to go to bed around 9, I think, or try to get to bed around 9. But yeah, it's just writing. I think I spend a lot of time. I think when the kids aren't around, it's strange. It's how I inspire myself, how I get motivated, but also how I wind down. I'll tend to type and type and type until I'm like this, and then I'm like, I go to bed.
Drifting off to sleep. I can't keep my eyes open anymore. Let's go to sleep.
Yeah. I mean, every now and again, like if there's something we really want to watch, which is only occasionally, we'll stay up and watch series on Netflix. Because every now and again, the series we want to watch, and sometimes we'll just watch that and go to sleep. But if not, I'll watch that, and then my husband will go to sleep, and I'll stay up to do some writing. So it's only select series we watch, but
yeah, it's interesting because everybody tells you like sleep is really important, go to bed early, don't, you know, it's so easy to get sucked into Netflix or the whatever. But I have to say, I mean, I feel like even just a little bit of time sometimes is nice to just unwind from the day. You know what I mean? So it's like, you know, the days that the kids are, we're able to get the kids, you know, they go to bed around, like I said, until what time they go to bed around like between 7:30 and 8. Or earlier if we're like really tired. Like we'll get them in, like, you know, we'll start bedtime at 7:15, but quickly we'll get them in, you know, by 8:30. So by 8:30, I'm like, oh, I have an hour. And you know, we'll just either now we're like into this, you know, Wordle was like a big thing that came out, you know, during the pandemic. It's like a word game. But and my husband will do it. Yeah. So like we didn't do it back then, but now it's like we'll do a little Wordle, spend 15, 20 minutes. Kind of it's a nice little way to end the evening. And then some days we watch a little bit of TV or we'll talk. But my bedtime, I say my evening routine is probably something I need to improve because it can range from like 10 o'clock to like 12 o'clock or just depending on.
I can imagine being awake that late.
And then when you wake up and you're like, whoa, what time is it? Yeah. So there's some room for improvement on my side from there.
Yeah. I think completely, like you said, it depends on energy levels because some of my favorite nights are just when we just, like you said, just lay there talking together about each other's day, what our hopes are and our dreams, all that kind of thing. But sometimes, like I said, just recently, if there's a series you really want to watch, we're like, the kids are about, just chilling, just like just zoning out just for an hour. And like you said, that hour is perfect. Just 60 minutes. Then afterwards we can go and talk or we can go to sleep or whatever. But for now, we can just chill out and just enjoy something that doesn't require any brain activity.
Exactly. It's just no thinking, no decision making, no nothing. Yeah. Tune it out.
Yeah.
Well, Becky, thank you so much. Thanks for humoring me on these questions. I always like hearing what other people do because it helps just bring some for sure. Well, thank you, Becky. This was a really great conversation. Thanks for sharing your story, and I can't wait for people to read your book.
Thank you so much.
Well, that was an amazing conversation, and I'm really happy that Becky came onto the podcast to share her story. And I took a lot from this conversation, and I wanted to share with you my takeaways. So number one, have the permission to feel guilty. Sometimes it's so easy to get lost in the world when we have our feelings but don't feel that we can actually have them. It wasn't until somebody just let her feel what she felt. And it was guilt in the circumstance when she got the diagnosis for her child. And she was able to get through the feeling with no shame once you give your permission to yourself to actually feel it. Number two, diagnoses don't have to define you. When Becky got her diagnosis, instead of using Google to find out all about the bad stuff or the bad things that could go wrong, she went looking for inspiration for individuals that defied odds. I find this so refreshing, and it's such a good reminder that your mind is a really powerful tool. When you go seeking for positivity, that's what you receive. And the opposite of that's actually true as well. So if you've been given hard news, know that you can use Dr. Google to your advantage and have a paradigm shift and how you might otherwise look at things. Number three, self-love is critical. I think that Becky's perspective on how she wants to raise her children and to encourage self-love is so important because if we love ourselves, it doesn't matter what the world around you says. and that they don't define who you are. You define yourself. Number four, find a support group. Connecting with other individuals is key. And Becky knew that, so she went and sought out support groups for herself. And now she is a leader and is really helping the community with her own groups that she has created to provide even more support. And last but not least, waking up early can make a profound difference in your day. We talked about this in our OPD segment, and it has come up on a few of my other podcast shows around the morning ritual. So I encourage you, if you haven't read The Miracle Morning, go get that book because it really will help you just kind of set your day straight. And of course, check out Becky's book, Thrive Rare, Embracing the Uniqueness Within. It's available on Amazon, and I will put the link in the show notes. I hope that you enjoyed this episode. Subscribe now, follow the show, rate it. Your reviews are what make the podcast reach even more people. I've had individuals from all different walks of life and various countries. I mean, this is a global podcast, and even the guests on the show, you can see they're around the world, and yet we still have so much to relate to and so much to share. So please keep sharing and following the show. All right, until next time, happy connecting.